Following the sermon. So I hope that you'll come be a part of that. Please open your Bible to the Gospel of John as we continue in our study of the Gospel of John. And today I begin a series in that Gospel I call The Passion of the Christ. You've heard that phrase before. Great movie using that title was made. This is The Passion of the Christ, Part 1. When we first began to study the Gospel of John, you might remember that I told you that this Gospel was written late in the life of John the Apostle. Most scholars believe that it was written not far from the first turn of the first century. John was in his 80s at the time. He'd had a lifetime to remember the words of Jesus and the deeds of Jesus. And by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, he saw some deeper meaning to those words and actions than even the other disciples had had the chance to do. The other Gospels were all completed by then. They were in circulation in the early church. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all had their own version of the events of Jesus' life. Matthew being a close disciple of Jesus, Luke an historian who compiled testimonies of eyewitnesses, and Mark, who actually was a young mentored person by Peter, the Gospel of Mark is actually the Gospel of Peter, written down by his friend John Mark. Now, I believe Mark's Gospel is written first. There's some technical reasons for that, but I believe it was written first, and the other Gospels used Mark as a source and then added their own material. But when it came to the Gospel of John, those other works were available. They were in circulation. And by the time the Apostle John wrote his gospel, the church was changing. No longer was it primarily a Jewish congregation. It was now almost exclusively, not totally, but very much a Gentile congregation. And by the time John wrote his gospel, Christianity was no longer legal. In the first years of Christianity, even when Paul was doing most of his mission trips, Christianity was considered by the Romans to be a version of Judaism, and they allowed Judaism as a legal religion. But by the time John wrote his gospel, the Roman world had decided that Christianity was what they call religio illicita, an illegal religion, and Christians were persecuted. John did not copy the storyline of the other three gospels. Those are called synoptic, which is a fancy word that means see together. They're sort of similar. John wrote his own version. And he concentrated on his own themes. And he wanted to show that Jesus was more than just a Jewish Messiah. Jesus is the Son of God and the Savior of the whole world. John wrote his gospel for Gentiles. And his primary point was to show that Jesus is the Savior. He began, you might remember, he began his gospel back before creation. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was what? Was God. He called Jesus the Logos, the Word who is equal to the Father and who is the actual creator of our world. He described how the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And he went on to say that as one of his followers, we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. John only recorded 7 miracles of Jesus. Now, Jesus did lots of miracles. John just picked 7 to show what Jesus could do. And he called those miracles signs. Signs that pointed to something. It pointed to the divinity of Jesus and the power of Jesus. And John would wrap up his gospel by saying, now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in His name. John didn't record any of the parables of Jesus, but he did record 7 great I Am statements of Jesus, in which Jesus would use the name of God and say, I am. I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Before Abraham was born, I am. And each time he did that, he was using Yahweh. Each time in the Greek translations, the ego imai, I am, showing I am God before you. Well, now we come to chapter 18 in John's book. This is the climax of Jesus' earthly life. This is what he came for. The love to be shown through the cross, the power to be displayed in the resurrection and the hope that is given in the ascension. The teachings of Jesus are all over. The training of the disciples is over. The earthly ministry of Jesus is over. Now it is time for his sacrifice, his human suffering, what we reverently call the Passion of the Christ. So let us reverently look at this passage. Let's begin. Chapter 18, verses 1 through 9, I call Grace in the Garden. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing that all would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. And when Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "Of those whom you gave me, I've lost not one." Jesus, with his disciples, leaves the city of Jerusalem and walks down Mount Zion, down to a brook that was between the mountain of Zion and the mountain of what was called the Mount of Olives, because there were a lot of olive trees on it. And he walked over a brook Kidron, which was really kind of an intermittent stream. It was just one of those gullies that when it was wet season, there was water, and when it was dry season, it was just a dry space. One interesting point of that brook Kidron, you know, during the Passover season, when they would have all the people bring the lambs and they'd offer them as the Passover sacrifices at the temple, then they'd take them back home to eat them. There were thousands and thousands of lambs that were sacrificed. I'm told that Josephus records that one year a census was done of how many lambs were sacrificed at the Jerusalem temple, and the number was over 256,000. That's a lot of dead lambs, and that's a lot of blood. And so the Jewish priests had ordered the construction of a channel that was built down from the temple down the side of Mount Zion into the brook Kidron, so that the blood of those lambs would run down the temple into that brook and would flow away. Isn't it interesting that Jesus, here at Passover season, is walking across the one whose blood would be shed the next day for the sins of the whole world as the true Lamb of God, walk across that stream. Well, he walked across that stream with his disciples, and he walked up the hill of the Mount of Olives. A lot of olives on that hill, that's why it's called that. And he walked to a private garden. Now, there were several private gardens on that mountain. You see, in Jerusalem, it was pretty crammed, and there wasn't much space for people to have gardens. And also, in Jerusalem, there was a law that you could not use manure on a garden in the city of Jerusalem, because this was the holy city, and you can't use manure in the holy city. So people who had money would have a private garden just outside the city on the hillside of the Mount of Olives. And one of those gardens, somebody who owned that garden gave Jesus permission to go there. Probably gave him a key, because the idea presented is that it's a walled garden. Gave Jesus and his disciples permission to use that space. And according to the other Gospels, he used it several times. He would go there to get away from the crowds, go there to have a private place to pray, and perhaps to talk to his disciples. Now Judas, being one of those disciples, knows about this place. And so he believes that that's the place we ought to check to see if Jesus has gone there. And Judas has gotten the agreement of the high priest and his group. And apparently they went to the Roman procurator, Pilate, and got permission to use some soldiers in this episode here. Because when it talks about a band of soldiers, the word actually refers to a cohort. Now, a cohort was a battalion, 600 men plus. Now, it probably didn't use all of them. Probably this is a detachment, maybe 50 to 100 soldiers, a detachment from that group. But Judas is leading Roman soldiers and what's called officers. Those mean temple police. Temple police are coming, 30, 40, 50 of them. I don't know how many. So you got at least 100 guys. Soldiers have swords. They wouldn't let the Jews have swords. The soldiers have swords. The temple police have clubs. And they all got lanterns and torches. And they're going across the garden, the Kidron Creek, going up the Mount of Olives. They're looking for Jesus. They have those torches because they expect Jesus to run. Now, it's Passover time. That means it's a full moon. So the light is pretty clear. Yet they expected Jesus to run and hide. So they have those lanterns and torches so they can find him if he hides. If he hides behind a tree or behind a bush or something, we'll get him. We got all these lanterns. We'll find him. Jesus didn't hide. Jesus stood there in the moonlight. Now, John doesn't record the prayer of Jesus. Those prayers were recorded in the other Gospels. John goes straight to the arrest of Jesus. And he says that Jesus was standing there. Now, he doesn't record that Judas comes up and kisses him, and that's what happened first. Judas came forward, kissed him on the cheek, said, "Hail, Rabbi." And Jesus spoke a word to Judas and said, "Do you betray the Son of Man with a kiss?" And then Jesus stepped forward and he addressed the mob. And he says, "Who are you looking for?" They say, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he literally says, "Yahweh, ego am I, I am." It's not "I am he." That's just written down in English to make it easy for us to read. It's "I am." And what happened when the Son of God said, "I am"? They fell backwards. They were caught off guard. Something about his voice and the dignity and power of the divine voice, they fell down. Roman soldiers fell down. Jewish temple police fell down. They fell down. You know there's going to come a day when they're going to fall down again. Said this time they're going to fall down on their knees and they'll stand before him. And then Jesus asked them again, "Well, who are you looking for?" And they said, "Well, we're looking for Jesus of Nazareth." And he says, "I am. So if you're looking for me, let these guys go." Even in that moment of stress, he's thinking about his men. He's thinking about his men. And so that's what happens. They do let him go pretty much, except there's one incident that takes place during all this tension. So let's look at verses 10 through 14. I call violence on the hillside. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, and the word means a small sword, something you could hide under your cloak. Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" Peter, being the impulsive guy, draws a sword. And he swings at the closest person to him that happens to be one of the slaves of the high priest. And the high priest ducks, but that sword catches him right across the side of the helmet, slices off his ear. I bet that hurt. Now, Peter's acting impulsively. How many guys did I say were coming there with swords and clubs? At least 100? He's got this small little sword. I'm going to take him on, Jesus. And I'm sure somebody grabbed him in that moment. But Jesus turns and rebukes Peter, and he says, "Peter, you don't know what you're doing. You're interfering with my mission. Shall I not drink the cup of judgment, wrath? Shall I not drink the cup of hell the Father is going to send to me? That's going to take the place that you having to experience it." Let's look at how Matthew describes it. Look at Matthew chapter 26, verses 51 and following. "And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear." I want to pause for just a minute and note that as we read Matthew and Luke's account and Mark even's account, they don't mention Peter's name. That's because when they wrote their Gospels, people were still around who were there. And they didn't want to get Peter in trouble. By the time John writes his gospel, those folks are dead. And it's okay to say it was Peter. All right. So somebody drew the sword. We know it was Peter. And Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place. All who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and He will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But then how should the Scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so? Peter, all I had to do was say the word, and thousands of angels would appear to defend me. I don't need you and your little dinky sword. But this is not God's plan for me to fight. These Romans and these Jewish police are ready for a fight, but it's not there for a fight. Jesus is not there for that. Let's look at how Luke describes it. Luke 22, verses 51 and following. Luke says, "But Jesus said no more of this." Jesus said a lot in that incident. "No more of this. And He touched his ear." Whose ear? Malchus's ear. He touched his ear and what? Healed him. That's the last miracle recorded before Jesus went to the cross. I mean, Malchus is holding his ear. It just got slayed. Maybe it's dangling off, you know, off the side right of his helmet. And Jesus reaches out and touches that ear and it healed him. I wonder what Malchus thought. I wonder what those soldiers thought. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and elders who had come out against him, yeah, they're following the soldiers. They're all brave guys. They're following the soldiers and the cops. "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. You boys are acting in sin, but that's okay. This is God's plan." Well, they arrested Jesus. Apparently, they let go of Peter. And they begin to march Jesus down the Mount of Olives, cross that brook again, back up the hill of Mount Zion toward the city of Jerusalem. The Roman detachment left. They went back to the Castle Antonia where they were stationed. They did their job. Now the temple police continue to carry Jesus on up. And of all places, they go to the house of Annas. The house of Annas. Annas is an interesting character. He had been high priest for 9 years before the Roman governor who was there before Peter, before Pilate. And the governor who was before Pilate fired him. He dismissed him. The interesting thing is that in the Old Testament scripture, the high priest was supposed to serve a lifetime. That was what God's plan was. The high priest was supposed to serve his entire life. But when the Romans took over in 6 AD, they made the office of the high priest a political appointee. And what would happen is the people who had the most money and could bribe the governor would get the job. You could hand the governor some bribe money, you could get the position. Well, Annas is one of those who got that position. And Annas became a very influential guy. In fact, over time, 5 of his sons and his son-in-law were named high priest. I mean, he's funneling money left and right. And he's a very powerful person. He's a very interesting character. He has a lot of rule in that area. And even though he's been dismissed as the high priest, and right now his son-in-law is the high priest, Annas is a very important person. Now, his son-in-law, Caiaphas, had actually predicted the death of Jesus. So let's look at the Gospel of John, chapter 11, verses 49 and following. But one of them, this is in a Sanhedrin meeting, one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, because it was a political position and it was waving, said to them, "You know nothing at all." You know, he talks to his fellow priests and says, "You're a bunch of dummies. You know nothing at all. Nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." The way he means that is that if we let this Jesus character continue, the Romans will come in and they'll take more control than they already have. We'll lose our jobs. We'll lose our positions. So it's better for this prophet from Galilee to die and things settle down. That's how he means it. But he did not say it that year on his own accord, because being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation. God actually used a man who was lost in a high position and had him prophesy something that was true. And Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. John said, Caiaphas prophesied, even though he didn't know it, he prophesied. Well, Jesus is brought to the household of Annas. And there's one more reason why he's brought to Annas before he's taken anywhere else. Do you remember when we studied through the Gospel of John that Jesus cleansed the temple? Do you remember that? He cleansed the temple at the beginning of his ministry, and he cleansed the temple again at the end of his ministry. And do you remember that he would say, you made my Father's house into a marketplace? And one of the things that was happening was the fact that they were selling so-called pure animals at exorbitant prices. Remember I told you that you could bring your own dove or you could bring your own lamb or your own goat, but they were sure to find in their inspection something wrong with it. And they say, well, I know you brought this goat outside the temple area for this price, but he's got a little spot on his right ear. We can't use that one. But right over here, we have a sale on goats. And you can buy one of ours. And from Barclay, I get the idea that I don't know about the goats and the lambs, but the doves, you know, because poor people could only use doves. You could buy a pair of doves for 4 pennies. The temple sold them for 75. You kind of get the idea. It's like going to a Braves game. You don't go to a Braves game hungry. Well, guess who owned that enterprise? Annas. That was his business. His family business ran the marketplace. So when Jesus cleansed the temple, not once, but twice, Jesus messed with his business. Jesus cost him money. So now, he, and being an influential guy, has Jesus brought to him, and he gets him in front of him and says, I got you now, boy. You ain't messing with my family business no more. I got you right where I want you. You're my prisoner. Well, while this is going on, we have another story going on. So let's continue on in our script here, verses 15 through 18, I call stupidity by the fire. Simon Peter followed Jesus. So did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood outside the door. So the other disciple who was known to the high priest went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, you're not also one of his man's disciples, are you? He said, I am not. Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold. They were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Now it gets a little confusing because it talks about the high priest. And what the deal is that Caiaphas still has the title of high priest. He's sort of the high priest emeritus. He's a retired high priest. Caiaphas is the acting high priest. But both of them are called high priest. Jesus is brought to the household of Caiaphas. And Peter and another disciple are following. And that other disciple knows the high priest. The high priest knows him. And there's no statement here that says who this is. But Christian tradition has long held that that disciple is John himself. Well, how could that be? How could a Galilean fisherman, particularly somebody who's about 21, 22 years old at the time, be known to the high priest or the retired high priest? Well, it's real simple. Remember we studied the Gospel of John, that James and John, two boys, were sons of Zebedee. And Zebedee was a wealthy fisherman. He had hired servants. Now, you couldn't transport fish fresh in those days. They didn't have freezers to put fish in. You couldn't ship it down in a freezing container. So what they would do is they salted the fish. Salting the fish would keep it fresh enough to transport for a while. And salt fish was a delicacy that the wealthy families would pay for. And so Zebedee, most likely, sold salted fish to rich people in Jerusalem. And guess who the delivery boy was? Youngest son, John. He would carry that salted fish down to these wealthy families, including Annas' family, and the people knew him. Here's the delivery boy. They knew him. He showed up every once in a while with a fish. And they know he's a disciple of Jesus by this point too. And so he comes to the courtyard and they know him. He's the fish man. They let him in. And Peter comes and he is standing outside because nobody knows this guy. And John goes up to the gate and says, "Listen, I want you to let my friend in." And the lady says, "Okay, all right, I know you, so if he's your friend, I'll let him in." And she turns to Peter as he walks in and says, "Well, you're not one of them too, are you?" That's the way the question's phrased. "You're not one of them guys too, are you? You're not one of those disciples of this man too, are you?" And Peter says, No. Excuse me, no. You know what he should have done? He should have turned around and left right then. He should have turned around. A prudent person would just say, "Oh, I'm in the wrong place." You know what? Peter doesn't do that. Peter goes up, and the officers who had the clubs just a few minutes ago, the officers made a charcoal fire, and they're standing around the charcoal fire in the middle of the courtyard, warming themselves, and Peter just sort of moseys up to the fire with them to warm himself. He's standing by the guys that wanted to arrest him just a few minutes ago, and that's where he stays. That's really pretty stupid. But he's loyal to Jesus. He wants to know what's going to happen to his Lord. So while he's being a little bit stupid, he's also showing a little bit of loyalty. And yet at the same time, he's showing some cowardice. The man that drew his sword an hour ago against 100 armed people, he got asked a question by a servant girl. He was scared. "Oh, no, I don't know him. I don't know him. I'm not with him. I'm just a buddy up with John here. We're in the fishing business together. I'm just hanging out with him for the weekend." Peter's also showing some scaredness. Well, you know, I got to be kind of honest with Peter, because we knock on him, and we're going to study a little bit more about knocking on him, I'll be honest with you. Because he really did deny Jesus 3 times. But it's also true that the very fact he was there showed his loyalty. Most people would not go near the fireplace with the temple police who just tried to arrest you an hour ago. He wanted to be where Jesus was. He wanted to know what was going on with his Lord. Well, while Peter's down in the courtyard warming himself with the enemies of Christ, Christ is in the upper room talking to Annas and his guys. So let's look at what I call truth in the residence, verses 19 and following. The high priest, this is Annas, the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I've spoken openly to the world. I've always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where all Jews come together. I've said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard what I've said to them. They know what I said." When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, "Is that how you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me?" Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Annas got right down to business. He wanted to find a charge that he could use to charge Jesus with in the upcoming Sanhedrin meeting. You see, even while they were there in this informal hearing, couriers were being sent out all over the city to summon the men of the Sanhedrin to come together that morning for an emergency 5 o'clock in the morning meeting. How would you like somebody to knock on your door, wake you up and say, "We need you at 5 o'clock in the morning in a meeting"? But that's what's happening. Couriers are being sent out to gather the Sanhedrin for an early morning meeting. Jesus is here in the house of Annas being questioned. And in this questioning, Annas broke every rule the Jews had of a legal proceeding. He broke them all. Well, he begins to ask Jesus about his disciples. "How many disciples do you have? Are they loyal to the Jewish faith? Are you in a rebellion against Rome? Are you leading a revolt? Are you training them on how to use the sword and fight against Rome?" Then they questioned about Jesus' teaching. "Exactly what are you saying to the people? How do you present yourself? We heard you said something about the temple being torn down. Are you going to attack the temple?" All kind of wild things. But the point of this is the simple fact that in Jewish law, the accused person could not be made to talk about himself. They're supposed to interview witnesses. And under Jewish practice, the witnesses for the accused are interviewed before those against the accused. Witnesses, both sides. There are not any witnesses in that room. They're harassing Jesus. And Jesus brings that point up to Annas. He says, why are you talking to me? Don't you know how this trial is supposed to be conducted? You're supposed to talk to the people who've heard me teach. I've always taught in public. I haven't hidden anything. In fact, even the teachings Jesus did for his disciples were nothing but explanations and expounding what he said publicly. Jesus asked the people who've heard me. That's the way you find the truth. And by the way, Annas, that's the legal way to do this. Annas is not interested in what's legal. He's not interested in justice. This is a kangaroo court. All he wants to do is find something he can charge Jesus with. Because conviction is exactly what Annas wants. Well, he doesn't find anything. And he gets frustrated. And so after some time, he has, all right, send him on to Caiaphas. Because if we manage to be able to come up with something, we can use it to the Romans. Because right now, those blasted Romans won't let us execute anybody. They hold that power to themselves. So if we can find a charge we can present to the Roman procurator, the Roman governor, it really has to come from the reigning high priest. That's my son-in-law, Caiaphas. He's got to be the one to present it to Pilate. So send him on to Caiaphas first. We're going to have our meeting in the morning. See if Caiaphas can get something out of him. And so they begin to send Jesus to Caiaphas' house, which actually was next door, Annas's. They shared a courtyard, as far as historians can tell. And in that courtyard, we see cowardice. Let's read on, verses 25 through 27. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. So they said to him, you also are not one of his disciples, are you? He denied it, said, I'm not. One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter again denied it. And at once, a rooster crowed. Well, if inside the room there was a faithful witness, outside in the courtyard there was a very unfaithful one. Peter's still in the courtyard. That's interesting to me. He's still hanging in there. And he's taking turns standing by the fireplace, sitting by the fireplace for a while, getting back up, standing by the fireplace. And while he's there, people begin to notice him. When Peter spoke, he probably said a few words. His Galilean accent gave him away that he wasn't Judean. You see, the Judean Jews had a little accent, and the Galilean Jews were rednecks. They had a different accent. And so people noticed that this is a Galilean Jew. He's got a redneck accent. And they begin to look at him, and as the fire was flickering, sometimes the flame would flicker and light up Peter's face, and people begin to notice him, and one guy really noticed him. He looked at that face. He said, wait a minute. A couple hours ago, I was in the garden. I'm sure I saw you. Weren't you there in the garden with this man Jesus? Weren't you there? And Peter's saying, no, not me. I don't know this guy. You know, John knew who this was. Interesting that in John's gospel, he names him. He names him, he says, a relative of Malchus. Because remember, John was the delivery boy. He went there to deliver fish all the time. He knew who Malchus was. And he knows that this guy's probably a cousin of Malchus. He's a relative. And this cousin of Malchus says, I'm sure I saw you in the garden. And you know what? The Gospels make it clear that several people chimed in. It wasn't just these three. They chimed in and said, yeah, we saw you. Yeah, you're one of them. And Peter, He denied it three times, but he denied it to several people. Does that make sense? A lot of people are saying this. And as he denies it the third time, something happens. At 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a changing of the Roman guard at the Castle Antonio. And when they do that, they blow a trumpet sound. And that trumpet sound is called the cock crow. Wakes everybody in Jerusalem up until they get used to it. You know, you kind of get used to things. I can remember when I was first out of college, and I was a radio announcer, WGGA, Gainesville, Georgia. I lived in a trailer. Doggone, that thing was right by a train track. And there was a train that came through and blew its horn about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And first few nights I was there, I said, you know, it wake me up, and I'd have to go back to sleep. And I eventually got used to it, and it just hardly bothered me. Well, there was this cock crow, this loud trumpet blasted 3 o'clock in the morning, and they called it that's what they called it, the cock crow. And at that moment, Jesus turns and looks at Peter. And Peter looks up at Jesus. Let's listen to how Luke tells this story. Luke 22, verses 56 through 62. Then a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the light and looking closely at him, said, "This man was also with him." Remember, a lot of people join in this. But he denied it, saying, "Woman, I don't know him." And a little later, someone else saw him and said, "You are also one of them." Peter said, "Man, I am not." And after an interval of about an hour, look how long he stayed. After an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, "Certainly this man was also with him, for he too is a Galilean. We can hear his redneck talk." Peter said, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." Immediately while he was still speaking, the rooster crowed. And I believe that rooster crowed is really the trumpet sound. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the saying of the Lord, how he'd said to him, "Before the rooster crows today, you will deny me 3 times." And he went out and wept bitterly. That sound happens. Peter glances up. Jesus is looking down at him. And all of a sudden, Peter remembers, "Jesus told me earlier this evening I was going to deny him 3 times. And I just have. I just have." And he ran out of the courtyard, ran down the streets of Jerusalem, crying bitterly, crying uncontrollably. He had failed his Lord. He denied his Lord. How could Jesus ever forgive me? The other disciples will disown me. I'm a complete failure. That's what he's thinking. And that's why we have to end the story here. That's the end of our story today. Aren't you glad that's not the end of the story? You see, the reason why Jesus looked down at Peter was not because Peter was a failure. It was because Jesus loved Peter. Jesus knew what God could make Peter, what he could change him into, what he could build him into. Jesus still believed in Peter. And Peter, as we'll see later, would find forgiveness, and he would find restoration. He would find strength because God wasn't finished with him yet. Did you know that God is not finished with us yet? He's not finished with us yet either. No matter how much we've sinned, no matter how much we've failed, God's not through with us. He knows what he wants to do in our lives, and he's still working in our lives. If you're breathing, God is not finished with you. That's the fact. If you're breathing, God is not finished with you. As Yogi Berra would say, it ain't over till it's over. And my friends, it ain't over. And here we have the example of Peter, who miserably failed his Lord and yet would become one of the greatest spokesmen for Jesus in the New Testament era. That's what God can do. God can change somebody. Our failures don't define us. God's love does. And that's what we'll continue to study as we study through the passion of the Christ, because that passion, that suffering, was because he loves us. That's what it's about. Let's bow for prayer.